I believe that no one else is coming in, so I think I'm going to call the meeting to order, and I'm going to ask everyone who is able to rise for the reading of the memorial resolutions. Let me start by recognizing Professor Stephen Vaughn to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus John T. McNally.
Professor Emeritus John T. McNally died in Madison on June 5th, 2014, at the age of 90. John joined the School of Journalism and Mass Communication in 1966. He specialized in Latin America and became recognized as the leading authority on media audiences in that region. After graduating from UW in 1946, he worked as a journalist and an editor, first for the Associated Press, then Reuters, and then in 1956, as the news editors for the UW News Service. After joining our faculty, he traveled often to South America where he did field research and taught. The UW Regents recognized his achievements in 1982, naming him an E.W. Bascom Professor. In 1988, the International Division of the Association of Journalism and Mass Communication conferred on John its Distinguished Service Award. There was much more to John, of course, than his professional accomplishments. He was a modest, soft-spoken, thoughtful person who had a lively interest in politics, an avid bicycle rider who was known to bike to professional meetings as far away as Minneapolis, and he was very generous with his time. And I can say, as a personal note, as a young faculty member, I'm grateful for having known John. A devoted family man, he's survived by his wife Pamela, his daughter Barbara, his son Duncan, and his granddaughter Laura.
Thank you. Let me call forward Professor Barry Artin, who's going to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus David Carl Peterson.
A talented and creative individual, Dave Peterson was initially inspired by Professor Robert Gard, founder of the Wisconsin Idea Theater. Dave wrote and produced musical comedies based on Wisconsin folklore. Dedicated to the Wisconsin Idea, Dave founded the Heritage Ensemble in Door County. For 20 years under Dave's direction, it performed in Peninsula State Park and toured the state. In the 1960s, he toured his shows to military bases in Europe, the Pacific Rim, and the Caribbean for the USO. Dave retired in 1995, but continued writing, performing, and working in the arts up until his death, and in addition, created and marketed successfully an incredible line of artisan bratwurst. He died peacefully on October 8th, 2014 in his home, surrounded by his family.
Thank you, and I want to recognize Professor Peterson's wife, Joan, and his daughter and granddaughter, who are all here. Thank you very much for coming. And let me recognize Professor Emeritus James Skiles to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Daniel K. Wheaton.
Well, thank you. Emeritus Professor Daniel K. Wheaton, Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, died in February of this year in Fargo, North Dakota, where he also had his undergraduate degree in electrical engineering. He was a specialist in electric power systems. The Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers named him a Life Fellow for his many technical contributions. He joined the faculty here after he received his PhD, and the students voted him an outstanding instructor during his period of time here. He supervised the research of 51 master's and doctoral students during his career at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. After retirement, he remained active in several technical areas and continued his promotion of wind power as a renewable energy source for electrical generation. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. You may be seated. Let everyone here who's coming in get seated. There is a handout from the Committee on Committees. Does someone have a copy to hold up?
The
Steve, do you have a handout? Hold it up. This is encouraging faculty to join one of the many committees that are so important for the shared governance of this campus. In particular, there are four committees with spring elections that are looking for candidates, and the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty, see Steve over here, can answer any questions and take any nominations. So I encourage you to look at that handout and pass it around to your fellow faculty, if you will. I have a number of announcements just to keep people up to date with what's happening on several things. We have a number of searches underway. The search for the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education, that search committee has been named and has had its first meeting and are moving forward. The search for the Dean of the Graduate School, that committee is underway and is working as ready as well. There are two vice provosts we are searching for. The vice provost for diversity has a call for nominations out at this point, and the vice provost for admissions is also working hard. And I note with some degree of sadness, I see Julie is here, that I think you all probably heard that the Dean of Education, Julie Underwood, has announced after 11 years, did I have that right? More, less? 10, it only feels like 11, is going to be stepping down at the end of this year. So we are in the process of initiating that search as well. So that is where much activity going on the search front. And if you have names for any of those searches that you want to put into the process, be sure that you feed them to the appropriate chairs and committees. Budget update. The election is over. I think the last time we talked, I told you nothing was going to happen until after the election. The election is over. The governor is at this moment in the process of putting his budget together, which will be submitted to the legislature and the Senate, probably in January, maybe as late as February. We are in the midst of working with the governor's staff. We have asked a number of close friends of both Madison and of the system to have some conversations with the governor about the importance of our budget. And we will see how that process unfolds. And once that gets sent to the Assembly and the legislature, the focus will shift there. And the debate will be within those two bodies. And we will be working on that front. It's still early days. And until we actually have a public budget from the governor, we don't quite know where we are. But that is where it is. The diversity framework, which you all adopted, which was a UC committee that reported in at your last meeting, as I think I noted to you, we were going to be in the midst of forming working groups to work on a number of those resolutions of faculty and staff and students. And we have six working groups that are underway that will be reporting in early next year, coming, you know, talking about how we can work on the resolutions from that committee and move forward in expanding and enhancing some of the things we do here, both in terms of hiring, promotions, as well as just general culture to enhance diversity and to be a open and a welcoming community. Finally, last comment that I want to make, I think some of you have probably heard this news. We received the largest single gift that the university has ever received a few weeks ago. This was announced from John and Tasha Margridge, a name that will be familiar to many of you because this is hardly their first gift to the university. They gave us a $100 million gift, and what is particularly sweet about this, for this group especially, is that this gift is all dedicated towards faculty chairs and faculty support. And it is a matching gift. It will encourage others to give money towards a faculty chair, and it will be matched 50-50. So if any of you have $1 million and are wondering what to do with it, if you gave us $1 million, the Margridge gift would match $1 million, and you would have a $2 million chair. It is a particularly Margridge-like aspect of this gift. The name of that chair would be the name that you selected. Their name will not be on it. One of the things that I observed when I first came here was that we just had amazingly few faculty chairs for a university of this size. We have about 136 funded chairs. Only 34 of those are funded at the $2 million level or higher, and $2 million is our minimal funding level for a faculty chair. And of course, those were given by generous donors in the past when we didn't have that level set. Right? And the mortgage gift will both allow people to add money to their chair and be matched to bring that chair up to $2 or $3 million, as well as initiate a new chair. And My hope is if you have $100 million and you match this with another $100 million of matching money, you can do the math and you know if the average chair is $2 million, we're going to have 100 new chairs around this university. And that is a transformative gift for faculty support, for our ability to attract, to retain, to really recognize the best talent at this university amongst our faculty. So I just want to say that's a gift that I hope all of you, if you don't have a department chair working on finding donors for this, go tell your department chair to get to work. I know we've got a number of deans who are already hard at work talking to people about potentially taking up this match. And my goal is we use up the $100 million, we've got to go find someone to give us some more matching money before this campaign is over. That would be wonderful. Finally, I would just note for those of you who are sports fans, we've had really a great fall in sports, and I'm not just talking about football, though of course we are playing in the Big Ten championship game. We won the Big Ten championship in women's volleyball. We did in men's cross country. We've just done a great job across the board in sports this fall, and I happen to think that college athletics, for those who participate in it at a high level, is an important educational experience, and it's important for our community. It's not the only thing, obviously, that's important, but I do want to celebrate accomplishments when they happen. And any of you who want to be in Indianapolis this coming Saturday night, the Big Ten Championship will be played as we face Ohio State in football. You do not have anything to report, is that right? Are there any questions for either Joellen or for myself on anything that has come up over the past month? Seeing no questions, it is time to turn to the minutes, which are on page 7 and 8 of your packet. These are the minutes of the 3rd of November, 2014. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, I'm going to declare the minutes to be approved as written. Thank you all very much. Let me now recognize Professor Greg Moses, who is going to submit for informational purposes the final report of an ad hoc committee on classified research. And I hope all of you have had a chance to look at this. There are quite a few appendices and other documents, and it's a long overdue report, I think, in terms of recommendations about to formalize how we deal with classified research and where we don't deal with it here on this campus. So, Professor Moses.
Thank you, Chancellor Blank. My name is Greg Moses. I'm a professor of engineering physics, and I chair the university committee's ad hoc working group on classified research. I joined the faculty here 39 years ago, and over that 39 years, if anybody had told me that I would be addressing the faculty senate on the subject of classified research, I would say that, well, yeah, right, when hell freezes over. On the other hand, having walked up here from the engineering campus today, maybe we're a close approximation to that. Given the nature of this, I'm going to ask your indulgence to let me read kind of a statement here that the committee's approved for me to say, and it'll keep me on track, and it'll go very quickly, although it will take several minutes. I'm here today to report on our working group's findings and to answer questions. I'll preface my report with a brief explanation about the formation of the working group and the charge to the working group by the university committee. Let me ask if there are any other members of the working group here besides, I know Dan Elric is here because he said, oh, here we go. Okay, Michael Falk is here too from WRF. Okay, so here we go. Formation of the working group. The working group was formed in March of 2014 in response to two related events that occurred sort of in the past year. The first was the Wisconsin Senate Bill 578. Which is an act to create statutes relating to classified research at the University of Wisconsin system institutions and exemption from open records requirements. It was signed into law on April 16th of 2014. I'm not going to read you the whole bill. It's in the appendix. A couple of important points are the Board of Regents shall report annually by September 1 to the Joint Committee on Finance the number of research contracts considered under processes established under Senate, blah, 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 and the outcomes of those contracts. All right, so there actually is a reporting requirement going forward on the activity of the UW system institutions in the arena of classified research. The second is the expenditure of U.S. Department of Commerce economic development funds to build a sensitive compartmented information facility, SCIF. It's an acronym. If you Google SCIF, it'll bring up all kinds of things. It'll describe you what it is. It'll tell you what the government rules are for building one. You can even find companies that you can call and they'll build one for you. So money was spent to build a SCIF in which classified research can be conducted near UW-Madison, and that is actually in existence now. Okay, so the charge to the working group by the university committee, and again, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to make a few points. One, to identify, clarify, and recommend updates to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's policy on research activities for which its sponsors impose mandatory protections of confidentiality and or restrictions on public availability. And so the working group focused solely on U.S. government classified research, and we did not touch the area of industrial proprietary research and such, because it's a very broad field if you use the idea that you're just restricting publication. And so we focused more on all of the aspects that go along with doing U.S. government classified research, which is, as you might imagine, rather involved and cumbersome. To that end, we are to describe the benefits and the challenges of participation in classified research projects, review past UW-Madison policies regarding classified research. I'm not going to review these in detail. There's a couple of documents that are the governing documents, and they tend to focus on the freedom to publish rather than all the details of doing classified research. Review policies of peer institutions and determine best practices that are applicable to UW-Madison. We reviewed the policies at the following schools: Johns Hopkins University, MIT, the University of California, Georgia Tech, the University of Michigan, University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, and Penn State. Each of these universities has either a current or a past activity in classified research. Okay, so here are the findings and the recommendations. Creation, stewardship, and dissemination of knowledge are among the foundational principles of institutions of higher education. The right to disseminate newly created information lies at the heart of academic research enterprise. Publicly funded universities, such as the University of Wisconsin-Madison, have a particular responsibility to ensure that the discovery and knowledge generated at that institution are shared broadly with the citizenry of the state, nation, and world. Indeed, one of the hallmarks of this university, the Wisconsin Idea, urges that the insights gained by those on campus be disseminated widely for the benefit of the broader community. Nothing in this report is intended to suggest a retreat from these principles. That's a rather very high-minded statement, but the strength in that statement comes from the fact that it's the truth. There was no part of our discussion that involved any retreat from the principles that have guided this university for a very long time. While some universities would appear to have embraced classified research as part of their portfolio, in fact, they maintain separate and distinct facilities that are more accurately described as U.S. government national laboratories operated by the university as a public service. Many of these separate laboratories date back to World War II. Two of those that are always come to mind among people that live in this world are the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University and Lincoln Laboratory at MIT, both of which had their origin during World War II. Okay, and the final statement is, national security is challenged today by unconventional forces, e.g. enemies who are not defined by national boundaries and or through non-traditional means, e.g. attack through cyberspace rather than physical insult. Thus, it is appropriate to review UW-Madison's current policy in classified research at this time and make necessary recommendations for changes in policy. And again, just parenthetically, I think that the underlying idea here is that our national security infrastructure is working to make this a safe place to live. And just as during World War II, they looked to universities for help in that regard, today they're doing the same thing. The following recommendations are abbreviated from the more verbose form in the report. I'll remove all the contextualization for purposes of brevity here. I'm almost done. So there's seven of these. Recommendation one, the university recognizes the value of access to classified research opportunities for faculty, staff, and students, and therefore will develop streamlined policies and processes for access to appropriately secured off-campus facilities to enable such research. Two, the university authorizes faculty to devote effort to classified research. We're purposely vague. This is a report. All of the actual rules have to be developed yet. Three, the university authorizes academic staff and students to participate in classified research. Recommendation four, classified activities will not negatively influence university decisions of promotion and tenure for faculty. Five, any principal investigator engaged in classified research will be required to provide a notification letter to students and academic staff indicating that if they agree to participate in classified research, it may result in inability to publish. And recommendations six and seven are purely administrative. The university will create administrative processes consistent with U.S. government security laws that allow classified research to be conducted by UW faculty for an outside agency or organization in separate secure facilities. The outside agency or organization will handle all contracting and other business-related issues. And then seven is kind of the easy one. The university will create administrative processes that allow subcontracts from outside agencies that do classified research for the purposes of supporting UW faculty, staff, and students' participation in unclassified components of the research. This is already possible today for unclassified research. And so those are the seven. Thanks for your attention, and I will entertain any questions.
Hi, Noah Weith Feinstein, District 18. Although the report is framed in terms of national security, and there is language at the outset which discusses the U.S. government classified research, the language of the recommendations is not so specific and speaks of classified research in general, or at least does not make a distinction between government research and industrial research, for instance. My concern looking at the recommendations is that they might be applied broadly as a precedent to both government research and classified industrial research, which to me seems to have different implications. Is that also your read of the recommendations?
I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, no. I can just state again, the focus of the working group was, I mean, we made the conscious decision at the beginning of the process to look at only U.S. government-sponsored classified research. And so that's certainly what the intent is, rather than to look at proprietary industrial research. There's lots of proprietary industrial research, and each
already
one of
on
those
campus.
Goes along with its own separate set of rules.
So your own interpretation of those recommendations is that wherever it says classified research, the intent is classified research as sponsored by the U.S. government.
Yeah, and subject to all of the government laws and security regulations that go along with it, which are substantial.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other comments? I will note this is for informational purposes only. This lays out a series of recommendations, and to follow these recommendations, we need to codify this into a policy. The Vice Chancellor for Research's office will be working with the lawyers to produce that policy. We will be working closely with the UC. As you all know, the VCR is creating its new faculty governance group, the
URC,
the University Research Committee. That group will be consulted on this, and we expect to follow these recommendations as laid out. So anyone who wants to be involved or get a report back on that should let us know.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks to you, Greg, and thanks to your committee. I appreciate it. You should now turn to page 16 in your packet. I'm going to recognize Professor Chuck Saprinsky, who's going to submit for informational purposes only the annual report of the Research, Safety, and Compliance Oversight Committee. Chuck.
Thank you, Chancellor. I have nothing to add beyond what's in the report, but I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have. That's it.
All right.
Thanks.
That is it. That was easy. All such reports should be so easy. For those of you who are wondering why you got free coffee and cookies, my understanding is that Profs always offers this annually when the Profs annual report is submitted. So you can thank Professor Grant Petty, who's going to submit for informational purposes only the Profs annual report. Grant.
So I want to start by just reminding people what PROFS is. PROFS stands for the Public Representation Organization of the Faculty Senate. It is an organization that was established by the Faculty Senate in 1976, so it's been in effect for 38 years. The function of PROFS is to represent UW-Madison faculty interests before the state legislature, the governor, other state and federal agencies, the U.S. Congress, and the public. The emphasis in this work is on things like compensation and benefits for faculty, UW-Madison budget, and other important regulatory issues. The University Committee, most of which is seated up here right now, is the Board of Directors of Profs. And there is also a steering committee that consists of people drawn from across campus, a number of very capable and engaged faculty members who help set the priorities of Profs going forward. Last year, the president of the steering committee was Bill Tracy. He served 3 years and stepped down just this last November. And I don't think he's here today, but I'd like to thank him for his really dedicated service to this and many other activities on campus related to speaking for the university and for public support of the university. In addition, Profs employs a part-time lobbyist, Jack O'Meara, and a part-time administrator, Michelle Felber, both of whom were here giving coffee and cookies out a short time ago. Michelle is still here in the back by the entrance. I think Jack had to go for another engagement. And they are really the key to getting things done with Profs. They organize all of the activities. They organize forums and meetings with representatives from the state legislature and from our Congress. And Jack goes down to the other end of State Street very often to meet with officials and staffers there, and frequently recruits faculty members to join them there to basically speak for the UW-Madison faculty. A very important point that I want to more or less close with, because of the rest of the details about Profs and what it did during the last year are in the report that you have in your materials, is that Profs is a voluntary dues-supported organization, and it basically is supported by faculty agreeing to a voluntary 0.1% deduction from their paycheck based on their nine-month salary. That would work out to $7.77 per month for somebody on a $70,000 nine-month appointment. So it's not a lot of money, but the money is absolutely crucial to supporting Jack's activities, Michelle's activities, and we'd like to really encourage you to take back to your departments the importance of becoming a member of Profs and signing up for that voluntary donation. It's the way that Profs is able to function and represent the faculty at the other end of State Street. Last year, we added 22 members to our current membership, which I think is on the order of a few hundred. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but we certainly would like to have more to really ensure adequate support for what Profs does. Thank you, and I'll take any short question that you might have or talk to you after the meeting.
Was it 0.01 or 0.1?
I believe it's 0.1%. I hope that's right.
Michelle is nodding yes.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any questions? All right. Thank you. Items 8, 9, and 10, we're going to follow each other. And let me just tell you what we're doing so you know where we're going here. Item 8 is when Professor Ivy Karfus is going to submit the annual report on the Disabilities Accommodation Advisory Committee. And she will then present an updated reasonable accommodation policy for adoption. Item 9, she will move adoption of this, and we will vote yes or no. Assuming that we vote yes, item 10, Professor Joellen Fair is then going to move to adopt changes in faculty procedures that will make those procedures consistent with the new disability policy. This is a first reading of this, but the UC believes strongly there is nothing controversial in this at all. As soon as I say that, I have to knock on wood. And therefore, you will be willing to hear the report and vote on the proposed changes immediately. So I'm going to call Professor Ivy Karfus forward to first submit for informational purposes the annual report of the Disabilities Accommodation Advisory Committee. Ivy.
Good afternoon. You have the report in your agenda materials.
Page 22.
Thank you. And I would just like to bring a few highlights of that report to you. It's mostly self-explanatory. This is for the academic year 2013-14, as well as through now. We got a little bit of a late start since the committee wasn't fully constituted until October of 2013. So we were a little late start, and we got an extension thanks to the UC, so we were able to push that and get our work done by the end of October, and we submitted our final report to them, which you will hear more about in the way of policy recommendations, on November the 6th. I want to draw your attention in the report to the committee's charge, which was to review the University of Wisconsin-Madison's policy and process for faculty accommodations based on disability, and to make recommendations to the UC and Faculty Senate to bring the policy into compliance with the ADA. The previous policy was dated 1995, and there had been a lot that had changed in state and federal law since then. The committee looked at the best practices, and we tried to review CIC institutions, peer institutions, see what models were out there, best practices, as well as interviewed chairs, directors, and deans. And I'll use those three terms since depending upon the school or the college, it depends if you've got a chair or a director or a dean, to see how their experience in handling those that process was and what that input might be. And then we also sent out an email call to all faculty, you probably all received it, requesting that faculty with disabilities who would like to have a give confidential input as to their experience with the process, to have that information from the other side of the table. And we took all that information together. And I want to thank the committee, and some of the members are here, for working very hard and being a very thoughtful body that looked at these policies. And I want to publicly thank them for all that work. So we took that all information together, had various deliberations, worked very hard, and we did make recommendations, which you will see and hear later in the form of recommendations to bring us into compliance with the ADA, the American Disabilities Act. Basically, as you see in the report, there were some areas of concern that we just not only saw from reading the previous policy, but also from our conversations and research to other peer institutions, that we really felt there needed to be, and was expressed to us clearly, a more professionalized model where people who are trained in accommodations actually had some input and dealt with and led the process at the beginning, as well as to try to make the process more feel more safe and welcome to the faculty who wanted to make those accommodations, to try to take some of the power dynamics out of the situation, as well as the concern not only from the people who we interviewed, but also looking at the document from 1995 for the concern for medical confidentiality, which was a major concern with the old policy. So we tried to use those focal points as we went through and the information we had, and we drafted and submitted our recommendations in the form of a new policy to the UC. And that will be coming up later in the next point. So those are basically the highlights, and I would be happy to take any questions.
So
there are other people.
The submission of the annual report is for information only. Are there any questions on the annual report? Seeing none, we will move to the next item, in which Professor Corvus will present a reasonable accommodation policy, which you will have to vote on.
Right. So I guess, as I understand it, before I start anything else, I have to move this policy, correct? So I would like to move, this is University of Wisconsin faculty document 1159B. And I would move the acceptance of that document.
This is page 26. Is there a second to that motion? All right. Ivy, I'm going to call on you first if you want to say
yes.
A few words about this, and then we'll see if there are comments.
Because I would like to give you, again, to thank the committee for all their work. It was, a very thoughtful and hardworking committee, so there are members here, and I want to thank them all. I want to just bring out some highlights. It's a long document. It's about 9 to 10 pages, so I don't want to go through point by point. I don't think that's also necessary. The first couple of pages are mostly definitions, contacts, information, basic objective information that everyone needs to know for definitions and for context of what we talk about later on. I'm going to kind of summarize the purpose and the major changes. You do not have here the old document from 1995, document 1159A, that was the policy we were bringing into compliance. The reason is when we, and very dutifully, tried to make a document which merged with strikeout and highlights the old and the new, and it was hideous because basically we wrote the whole document over again because there wasn't much we could keep. To try to bring us into compliance and do all the things we wanted to do to make that legal for state and federal law. Two of the big overarching changes were that in the old document, and you can find it online if you wish to actually see it, is the chair slash director slash dean was the point of contact. The faculty member went to that person, presented the request for accommodation. That person gathered the information, had medical documentation if required, and made assessments and accommodations. I went through that process, and we are not trained as chairs, directors, or deans necessarily to do that. And luckily, Barb Lancer, who's in the OED and is the person who deals with it, guides us through it. But in the policy document, there's a concern for that chair, director, dean being the person receiving all of this, as well as not only trained, is that person trained to be able to know what a reasonable accommodation is, also the very concerning matter of medical confidentiality of records and keeping them separate and keeping them confidential and HIPAA, et cetera. So you will see as you look on page 4, I believe it is, that we have followed a model which is more a more point of professionalized context. The DDR, which is Divisional Disabilities Representative, is the person who receives this first point of contact and who gathers the information and who makes an individualized assessment of the individual case to come to a recommendation of what would be a reasonable accommodation for that situation, for that context, for that person. And that would be the person who would gather and request medical information if required, and that would be kept in a place outside of the department records where there's not a great possibility that will be mixed up with personnel files. That person would make a recommendation to the chair. It's not that we're taking the chair, director, dean out of the picture, but we're trying to put that decision and that gathering of information in the hands of a person who is a professional HR person who's trained to know what is a reasonable accommodation for this situation. So that's one of the overarching changes between the old policy and the new, as well as the fact that there's expressed more often as the need for medical confidentiality. Those records are now held by the DDR, not by a chair. And the DDR releases what is needs to know to the chair or the EC, depending upon the context, the issue, whether an EC needs to be, the executive committee needs to be involved or not. So again, only that was released as needs to know, so that the confidentiality is very protected and secure. So again, that's one of the major focus of the change in the two policies. Who's the initial contact? It also helps relieve the power dynamic concern, especially with junior faculty, of going to a chair or a director or a dean and asking for consideration, even if it's only a perception. Many expressed that they were feeling very stressed having to do that. So having going to the DDR, the representative, takes it also kind of a neutral zone outside of the department, but then brings back to the department to bring that information to the people who knew to make, who get the recommendation and say, this is the recommendation for this reasonable accommodation, and then can authorize and vote and decide on the action for that. So we're trying to make it more professionalized, less tense, more secure, more welcoming. And so in that, and also more secure for medical confidentiality. So the other big change that I would like to point out is the role of the Disabilities Advisory Committee, the DAAC, as we like to call ourselves. And that's on page 6. It is point 3H. This committee really hadn't been working, hadn't been constituted for several years. And Barb could maybe remember how many, but it's a few. As FPMP and as the previous document states the purpose of this committee, it was actually a committee who received confidential medical information and who made assessments and participated in this process. We would like to take ourselves out of the business. We don't think that any faculty committee of this type should be receiving confidential medical information. We are not trained. I may not be on the committee probably is not trained to make those kinds of assessments for what is a reasonable accommodation for this instance. So we have rewritten, and that will be another point that will be coming up, but it's the new policy describes the DAAC now as more of a policy body, that we look at the policy as well as a resource and an information and in moments of difficulty, needing assistance in difficult situations. We are there as a resource, we're there to help and to review policy. So that's another big change which will be that we made into the policy, and that's the role of the committee is being rethought. So again, that's basically the high points. There's also, this applies to applicants, so you'll see information for applicants, so that information about the policies and processes are clearly stated when people apply for positions, and it's known, it's laid out, and again, it's taken to the DDR. So that confidential information is also not passing around during an interview process. And there is also an appeals process, which is in Section 4, and that is only for current employees. It's not for applicants, but it is an important part of the process. If some employee feels that there needs to be an appeal, there is a process for that. And again, it is taken out of the hands of the chair, Director Dean, and it's put to the a disabilities coordinator, a kind of, again, a neutral outside party, who will then deal with that appeals process as is outlined. So I guess I will stop there. Those are the big differences that you see between the old, well, you don't have the old document, but it was impossible to do a merge to show you since it was significantly rewritten. And I would happy to take, and we have committee members in the audience who will also help to take questions or statements regarding the policy.
We have a motion on the floor that has been seconded to adopt this policy, so we are open for discussion on the issue.
Hi, Ellen Samuels, District 116. I was also a member of the DAAC working on this policy. So of course I'm speaking in support of it. I just want to briefly note that as a faculty member with a physical disability, I'm very open about that. I was hired to do disability studies. I travel around the country regularly talking about having a disability. And yet, in my experience here as a faculty member receiving accommodations, there were times the process was incredibly confusing, difficult, and disheartening, and I think would not have succeeded in making sure I received the accommodations that I legally was required to have and needed if I hadn't had an extraordinarily supportive chair and department. And of course, these processes shouldn't rely on people always having extraordinarily supportive chairs and departments. And now I've been on the other side of it, sitting on an executive committee in two different departments, receiving requests for accommodations from other members of the department, and it really, my own experience supports what is in our report. What we found in talking to other people is that the current system was really broken and really quite appalling in the way that it worked. So I really encourage you all to support this policy change. It will make not only the lives of faculty with disabilities easier, but also so much that of the chairs, directors, deans, and executive committees. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jean Swack, District 65. And first of all, I want to thank you for completely starting over with this document, because having a disability discussion in my department with when I was a junior professor was one of the most humiliating and awful experiences of my career here. I wanted to ask about the accessibility of our classrooms and the campus as a whole, which has been very problematic in the department where I work. For example, last year I asked for an accessible classroom, which was a huge error on my part, and was sent to another building that had an accessible classroom that wasn't actually accessible to get to. We have a lot of buildings that don't meet the requirements of the ADA, and even getting up here to the Senate meetings is always kind of a trial. So I'm wondering if you could address the facility problems.
Well, I can just say that in our policy it is mentioned, and I agree with you completely. There are difficulties negotiating and traveling from campus and even getting in buildings from one floor to another. There has been the new bus system, that is working, helping some now. And as the policy goes and as we worked with that, we recognize this problem, but the policy is not something that we can actually enforce for physical plant. We have a part in the policy where if there is a disability that requires physical renovations, that is discussed and then taken over to physical plant. And based upon their procedures and budgets, it is done, but that's bigger and better powers than what. And
Yeah, I'll notice this is an important issue, but it's not one that's directly addressed in this.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
So for specific requests, I'm Barb Lancer in the Office for Equity and Diversity. So if you have a specific request, Hygiene, regarding accommodation for your classroom or if you need an alternate classroom, you definitely, if this process is passed, would work with your DDR. So for individualized requests, though I do recognize there's a lot of buildings and spots on campuses that aren't generally accessible. And we do have in the facility planning and management, FPNM, a facility access specialist. So if you are aware of spots that you're thinking of, to definitely bring that to his attention. His name is Top Tanta Vivat.
Are there other questions or comments? Let me just make sure, does anyone who hasn't spoken have any comments? Otherwise, I'll go back. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just actually going to respond to that question. I'm sorry, I'm Ellen Samuels, District 116. That was really outside the purview of this committee. This committee was really charged to revise the FP&P policy for requesting accommodations. But there's another committee, the CAAI, Committee on Access and Accommodation and Instruction, that I'm also on. It'd be great to have more diversity of faculty on these committees, if anyone's interested in, just to echo the Committee on Committees voice here, that does think about these issues. And again, individual requests for accommodation, whether by a student or faculty, right, there's procedures in place for that. Larger structural issues require larger structural solutions, and that's something that the CAI is starting to think of and take up in a larger sense. So I encourage you all to participate in that if you're interested. Thanks.
Are there questions and comments on the policy?
Jim Dewing, District 65. I just noticed in 2E, it says a faculty member may be required to provide the DDR with verification. So they decide who should, can it just be that everyone needs to provide some verification from a specialist that there is an issue?
We left that up to the DDR to decide, since some things are visible and may not need a extreme medical documentation to show that disability. So rather than having everyone go through the process, if the DDR, who's trained to decide these things, doesn't need all the medical information, then we thought it was just so much more medical information that was confidential that didn't need to be brought into the picture. So
that just seems if we're going to end up having to change a classroom or change an office or get a new chair, that it would be good to just have a specialist say it, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, so in some cases, a disability is obvious. And in so those cases, we definitely wouldn't make a request for medical information in most of the time. But in many instances, a disability is invisible. And in those cases, we are almost always making a request that the faculty member or the employee provide information. And so the policy as proposed is now more aligned with the process for our classified and our academic staff. So we have, I'm responsible for training the DDRs or the divisional disability representatives. So I have a little over 50 people trained. It's generally your HR manager. And they have intensive initial training and then ongoing training throughout the year. And so they would make that determination about if we need that medical information or not. Thanks for the question.
Any other comments? If not, I'm going to assume you are all ready to vote. We need a majority vote to adopt this new reasonable accommodation policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Are there any abstentions? In that case, the policy passes. Thank you very much. And thanks to the whole committee for their work on this. Next item, which immediately follows, having passed that policy, we now want to make sure that the FPP is consistent with that policy. So, Joellen, do you want to?
I want to thank the committee for all of its hard work with the policy and also with the changes to FP&P. I move to adopt the changes to FP&P 6.33 to update the composition of the Disabilities Accommodation Advisory Committee.
Is there a second to that motion? You don't need a second. All right, because it's made by the UC. This is on pages 35 and 36 in your packet. It's the last two pages. It lays out the proposed changes in FPP that would basically make FPP consistent with the now recently adopted policy. Are there any questions, comments, or other things that people want to say about that? If not, I will ask you all to vote. All of those in favor of adopting the FPP changes, faculty document 2528, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right, that passes as well. I have an item that I want to return to, and before the parliamentarian jerks me off the stage for doing this, I want to go back to an announcement I made earlier because there's something I did not say that is very important. I want every one of you to know the answer to this, okay? I announced the mortgage gift. So when the state legislator comes up to you and says, I hear the university just got $100 million, we don't need to give you a budget increase. I want to make sure you know the answer to that, right? We do not have $100 million to spend. The foundation received $100 million in endowment. None of that money can be spent until there is matching money from someone else. When that matching money occurs, a chair for, say, $2 million is endowed at $2 million. We cannot touch the $2 million. We simply receive 4.5% annually, which, if I'm doing my math right, is $90,000 a year. And that money, in turn, is spent on some combination of salary and research dollars for the faculty who receives the chair. So please do not let anyone ask you why any of us need budget increases if we have a new $100 million to spend. We do not. We only have an endowment, which first has to be matched, and which is then paid out at 4.5%. And we cannot touch the original money. So I just want to make sure everyone is really clear about that, because I know that will come up in the next few months. So you all know what the answer is. All right, now we're completely out of order, but we are now at the point of discussing honorary degrees. We move into closed session for that, and I would like to have a motion to move into closed session pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 18.851C and F to consider the recommendation of the Committee on Honorary Degrees. Do I have such a motion? Is there a second? This requires a majority vote. All those in favor of moving into closed session, please signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right, I'm going to ask anyone who is not a member of the faculty or does not hold faculty status to please leave the meeting room at this point. And we will go into closed session, and I'll ask people in the back to close the doors.